Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the expected withdrawal from the JCPOA Iran agreement by President Trump today, which America's allies tried to warn against because the only winners will be the hardliners in Iran, who will be drawn closer into a strategic embrace with Russia and China, in spite of the yearning of the Iranian people to join the West and be free of the corrupt theocratic regime which has wrecked and looted their economy, but now has been given a new lease on life by Donald Trump. Abbas Milani, the director of Iranian studies at Stanford University, who taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, joins us to discuss today's tragic betrayal of hope for reform in Iran and a dangerous step away from diplomacy towards war. Given the volatile mix of proxies, surrogates, and Eric Prince's mercenary army in the Emirates, it would not take much to spark another war in the Gulf and the wider Middle East that neither the US or Iran wants, but one that Israel's Netanyahu, Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and America's new National Security Advisor John Bolton would love to see happen. Then we'll explore the roiling legal, moral, and ethical landscape between private behavior and public policy with the sudden downfall of New York's Attorney General Eric Schneiderman following revelations in The New Yorker of his violent private sexual behavior, which four women have come forward to report. Tiziana Deering, a professor of social work and co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College, joins us to discuss how this latest expose of a prominent liberal politician who is seen by many as the plan B of the Russia investigation if Trump fires Mueller fits into this era of the Me Too movement in the context of the U.S. having a leader who boasts about being a sexual predator and is increasingly mired in tacky sexual scandal. Yet his approval is going up in the polls. Then finally, we'll speak with Seth Hettner, the author of a new book just out today, Trump Russia, A Definitive History. An award-winning journalist who was a longtime investigative reporter for the Associated Press, he joins us to discuss the enormous amount of evidence he has compiled on Trump's dealings with Russia that go back to 1984 and reveal a long-standing relationship Trump has had with mobsters and organized crime bosses, which makes the case that Trump's business plan is based on laundering money for Russian and Ukrainian gangsters. And joining us now is Abbas Milani, who's a director of Iranian studies at Stanford University and a professor in the Division of International Comparative and Area Studies. He's one of the founding co-directors of the Iran Democracy Project and, until 1986, taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, where he was also a member of the board of directors of the University Center for International Relations, and he is the author of The Shah. Welcome to Background Briefing, Abbas Milani.
Thank you for having me.
So today, of course, President Trump did what was expected. He pulled out of the JCPOA, the P5+1 deal with Iran. As far as I can tell, it's basically a continuum of kind of government by stunt, where he does things like a reality TV star, which is what he is, and throws us all into confusion on a daily basis. I don't see what the substance to this is. It doesn't make any sense. The whole world, the European leaders have all been telling him not to do it, and yet he's gone ahead and done it. So what's your explanation? Is he acting at the behest of Netanyahu and Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia? Is he doing this because anything that Obama did, he has to undo? I'm trying to make sense of it.
I think it's very difficult to make sense of it. I certainly haven't been able to make full sense of it. I think some of the factors you mentioned are certainly at play here. The animosity towards Obama, I think, is very key in this scheme. Whatever he has done, he wants to undo. But I also think it is a part and parcel of this presidency, where I think more than any other president that I know of, that I've ever studied, the policy of the country is based on his whims and views, changeable though they are, based on very slim knowledge of the facts as they are, and as you indicated, not just contrary to what almost every ally of the United States has indicated, but also many of the top advisors to the U.S. government, including, for example, the Secretary of Defense, the past Secretary of State, the past National Security Advisor, much of the collective wisdom of many of the career diplomats and even intelligence agencies, those that have published their views, is that this was a very bad decision, that the deal was flawed, as it might have had faults, and I think it did, but it was the best thing that the Obama administration could have done at the time, and there is no upside to it that I can see.
Well, it does seem to be also driven by the neoconservatives who have made a comeback with John Bolton now at the right hand of Donald Trump as his national security advisor. Bolton is tied in with the MEC, the Iranian opposition group that was previously considered by the U.S. government to be a terrorist organization. They are talking about regime change. It's the worst kind of idea of regime change. It reminds me of Ahmad Chalabi in lead up to the Iraq war, where the neoconservatives saw him as the Nelson Mandela of post-Saddam Hussein Iraq, and look what happened. And we all learn, of course, in retrospect, that Chalabi was also an agent for the Iranian government. So, you know, the young people in Iran have been taken to the streets because of the government's closing down their social media access. They clearly hate this government. There was an uprising back in 2008 that was brutally put down. The country's obviously ripe for regime change, but regime change from within. And there's no way in the world that Donald Trump, Benjamin Netanyahu, and Mohammed bin Salman are the agents of regime change. I mean, won't the Iranians fight these people to the death? They're not liberators.
I think, you know, it's the first point of a country's sovereignty. Any country, and proud people of Iran, like every other country, want to be the masters of their own domain. They want to determine their own future. They want to determine their own regime change. They don't think, rightly, that any country, certainly not the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Israel, or any other country, has the right to determine Iran's future. And I basically think that this decision was essentially a godsend to the conservative elements in Iran. Because, as you indicated, not just in 2008, 2009, as recently as January, there were a large number of demonstrations in Iran. The Iranian economy, as we speak, is facing one of its most existential crises. The currency has lost almost half of its value in the last 2 months. Unemployment, double-digit unemployment, double-digit inflation, one of the most corrupt and competent economies, the domination of the IRGC on it, all of these things have brought people to the verge of, exactly as you suggest, challenging the regime, blaming it for its incompetence, blaming it for the incredible pressure that people feel on a daily life. Now it's going to be very difficult to challenge the conservatives, because the conservatives, first of all, are beginning to say already that we told you so, that the United States can't be trusted, and we told you so, that the United States is keen on regime change, and you know, they will, I think you can already hear in the last 2 hours, I've been looking at the social media and some of the commentators inside Iran, there is this sense that we can't allow Trump or any other outside force to be a determinant for our future.
And again, I'm speaking with Abbas Milani, who's the Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and a professor in the Division of International Comparative and Area Studies. He's one of the founding directors of the Iran Democracy Project and until 1986 taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, where he's also a member of the Board of Directors of the University's Center for International Relations, and he is the author of The Shah. So does that mean now that with the U.S. pulling out and adding sanctions, that the Russians, the Chinese, the French, and the British, and the Germans, all of who are co-signatories to the JCPOA, they are going to continue the deal, and therefore the Iranian hardliners will I mean, as bad as their economy is, I'm not sure how much the U.S. can do further damage if they're going to be trading with the rest of the JCPOA signatories. So would that mean then that the hardliners could basically blame these economic woes that you just told us about, Abbas? Could they therefore blame them on the Americans?
I think that that's very much clearly their strategy. They have already begun to talk about it. Some of the most conservative papers, beginning yesterday, they began to essentially propose this line of argument. Now, first of all, we don't know exactly how the U.S. will reimpose these sanctions, whether it will reimpose all of them, when it will be reimposed. There are some ambiguities. And I think more crucially, there is clear ambiguity whether Europeans are going to go along with sanctions that the U.S. might impose on countries outside the United States, companies outside the United States, if they do business dealings with Iran. Mr. Trump said, we're going to punish anyone who helps a nuclear program. But does that mean that anyone who does dealings with Iran will now have to face the possibility of the U.S. sanctions? If that happens, my guess is that the Europeans might push back. The Russians and the Chinese clearly are not going to abide by it. But U.S. sanctions in the past have hurt the Iranian economy, but they were never able to change the behavior of the regime. What changed the behavior of the regime, what brought it to a negotiating table, what brought it to sign this nuclear deal, which was a major rollback of Iran's nuclear program, was that Europeans and the Chinese and the Russians joined and sanctioned the Iranian economy. And when that began to hurt, and when the regime felt status quo is really untenable, then they were very eager to sign an agreement.
Well, it does seem that, as I say, it would be an extraordinarily shocking irony that American boys and girls will end up fighting and dying in a war against Iran to satisfy Benjamin Netanyahu and Mohammed bin Salman. I mean, I can't believe that we Americans are such suckers that we'd fall for that. But I don't believe the Pentagon wants a war. They're not ready for it, and they don't have the manpower, and it would be a massive undertaking. If you think Iraq was a disaster, if you take on Iran, it would be a disaster multiplied by 100. And, of course, they have missiles ready to lob at the Saudi oil fields. That would be shut down. The world would go through a massive global depression. The price of oil would go up to $10, $20 a gallon. This is the downside. Now, you think that they're on all around, there must be rational people, even in Iran, not wanting this, amongst the supreme leaders and the IRGC people.
I think so. I think for not just the element of rationality that I hope exists in some of them, although some of them have been doing things that are foolish. I mean, some of the missile tests that the regime did in the last few months, I thought was adventurism, pure and simple. The fact that then they put in Hebrew that these missiles are intended for the destruction of Israel was serious foolishness and gave exactly the kind of ammunition that Netanyahu needed. But I don't think the Iranian regime, even the most foolish ones, want a war because they can ill afford it at this time. And I think you're absolutely right. I think the U.S. government, even in spite of the rhetoric of Mr. Trump, doesn't want another war with Iran. I don't think General Mattis certainly wants it. I think the military realizes that this is a major undertaking. Iran is three times the size of Iraq. And it will be just a major catastrophe, not just for the U.S., but for the people of Iran, who are as much hostages to this regime and its conservatives as anyone else who has been ever held hostage by this regime or its proxies.
Well, just in closing, though, I brought that up to suggest, Abbas Milani, that even if neither the U.S. or Iran want a war, I would exempt Netanyahu and MBS from that. They think they do want a war, but they want us to fight the war for them. But the problem I have, or the thing that worries me, is that these proxies like the Houthis could fire a missile at the Saudi oil facilities, kill a bunch of Saudis. You've got Eric Prince, the mercenary army there in Abu Dhabi, and he could spark something. He's got the means to do so. There are a lot of wild cards here, so we could be dragged into a war that we don't want.
Unfortunately, that's true. I mean, it is the whole region is a minefield, a powder keg, if you will. And there are a lot of possibilities for misunderstanding, a lot of possibilities for a miscalculation. As you say, one missile that might do kind of damage that will beget response. So my hope is that cooler heads will prevail. But this decision today decreases the possibility of the prevalence of cooler heads and ever so gingerly increases that ominous possibility that you pointed to.
Well, just in closing, in other words, this is a situation that could get out of control very quickly. Therefore, it requires diplomacy. And instead of increasing our diplomacy or trying to engage with diplomacy, we're doing the opposite.
I think the situation in Iran does, in the region, I think it really requires diplomacy. It requires a very careful, attenuated diplomatic effort, because if you look at the whole region, the number of failed states, failing states, the number of non-state actors who are on the horizon, the economies that are reeling, the youth that are unemployed, the numbers are remarkable. 60% of Iranian women college graduates are unemployed in Iran, for example. 40% of the entire college graduate is unemployed. And the numbers are almost the same everywhere else you go. These are matters that are going to require serious strategic thinking. And this decision today, in my view, was not indicative of that kind of a move. And the other aspect we haven't talked about is what Russia and China might get out of all of this, how Russia will fare better, I think, in Iran, in the whole region, how China is sitting on the horizon, waiting. It has enough cash to, for example, help the Iranian economy, and the regime might have nowhere else to go other than China or Russia. And this repivot of Iran away from West towards Russia and China will have consequences long after Mr. Trump is no longer the president of this country.
Well, Abbas Milani, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Abbas Milani, who's the director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and a professor in the Division of International Comparative and Area Studies. He's one of the founding directors of the Iran Democracy Project and until 1986 taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, where he was also a member of the board of directors of the university's Center for International Relations, and he is the author of The Shah. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back exploring the roiling legal, moral, and ethical landscape between private behavior and public policy.
Mother, do you think they'll drop the bomb? Mother, do you think they'll like this song?
Well, Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Tatiana Deering, a professor of social work and co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College, as well as the former head of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston. Her research focuses on social justice in public policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tatiana Deering.
Thanks. It's nice to be with you.
Well, thank you, Tatiana. And how do we, as citizens, journalists, academics, how do we navigate this problem we have that's arising now with Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General of New York, who, after the New Yorker magazine did a profile on a number of women, I think four at least, who had revealed that he'd been quite brutal in sort of sexual activities with them. They hadn't come forward for some time, but nevertheless they came forward, and within a couple of hours, he was out. Now, a lot of people, of course, are concerned that he was like Plan B. If Trump fires Mueller, Schneiderman was supposed to pick up the slack. So there are all kinds of political implications. But the long and the short of it is, after Schneiderman and then prior to that, Senator Al Franken, how do you navigate between the public posture of a public servant and their private behavior?
It's a great question, and I think it is the question of the day. I mean, we are riding a social change convulsion in the hashtag MeToo movement now, and I think everyone is scrambling to figure out what the right patterns of behavior and consequence are going to be over the longer term. You know, I think in each one of these cases, Ian, we have to look at what parts are common and what parts are truly specific. So in the case of Eric Schneiderman, for example, he had really been quite out front on issues having to do with hashtag MeToo. You know, part of the Harvey Weinstein company's prosecution, lots of public statements in other public policy areas about the importance of women having control of their bodies, not being victims of violence, et cetera. So there's something quite particular about a man who has made public hay and public statements, especially on the legal front on this issue, then being so convincingly accused about it, of it. I think that's a little bit different, for example, than the Al Franken case, where not only were the accusations older, but he was not specifically situated. He hadn't specifically situated himself as a public leader in hashtag MeToo. Now, he was also on the front end of it. I'm not sure one could have done that at that time. But I think the context really matters, and it's part of what we've got to sort out here.
So, I mean, obviously in this country, we have an anomaly in terms of public morality or the lack thereof. We have a president, of course, who famously was revealed on videotape boasting about sexually harassing women. And nevertheless, he's the president of the United States. He got elected. And now he's more and more mired in scandal every day with a porn star and their activities being all over the headlines and lawsuits flying around. But at the same time, Donald Trump is going up in the polls, and he'll probably get another boost from the North Korean deal if that happens. And, of course, today he again threw a cat amongst the pigeons by pulling out of the Iran deal. So we have this extraordinary spectacle where you are asking yourself, where is the moral compass in the United States?
I think we are asking that, and I think a piece I would add to the really disheartening laundry list that you just put out there is this confusion over where white evangelicals in the United States stand. As a community that really self-positioned itself in the 90s and in the early 2000s as one of the leading moral voices in the country, I think it's also been striking to see the extent to which white evangelicals publicly have now declared that so many of these moral failings don't matter in pursuit of a very specific conservative, you know, social morals agenda. And I think that's been a really troubling part of this as well. It's incredibly disheartening to see the president of the United States guilty of such moral turpitude with no accountability. And I think that's really the word in this movement right now that we've all got to turn our attention to. What do we expect for accountability? What do we want for accountability? What are our mechanisms for accountability? And if we have institutions that aren't capable of executing accountability in a proper time frame, what new steps do we have to take? You know, part of the challenge is a four-year election cycle is the accountability cycle for an elected official who will not resign out of shame or disgrace. And so it is a long wait until the voters have an opportunity to exercise that accountability when it comes to the president.
And again, I'm speaking with Tiziana Deering, who is a professor of social work and co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College, as well as the former head of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston. Her research focuses on social justice in public policy. But there is accountability. I mean, there's no accountability on the Republican side and on the white evangelical side. But there is accountability on the Democratic side. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who led the charge to oust Senator Al Franken, has also been very quick to condemn Eric Schneiderman, and that I think the Democratic Party, they are not going to alienate the women's vote in this country. So half of our politics seem to have some sense of shame and the other doesn't. But where do we go forward, though, in terms of how do we deal with the pathology of politicians? Because whether they're on the left or the right, Democrat or Republican, so often they fall from grace and we learn all kinds of sort of things about who they really are. Is that something in that world of politics that's a sort of a pathology?
Yeah. You know, I think we're certainly seeing a pattern of disclosures here and accusations that suggest that. And whether we know that to be true, I'm not sure. And here's what I mean by that. Is it that there is something particular about political power? And sexual assault and sexual violence at their heart are about power. This is a well-documented fact. Is there something about political power that particularly lends itself to that behavior? Or is there something about politicians that are drawing out disclosure and accusation in a way that maybe other industries or other professions are not? I'm not sure we know that part, Ian. So as a result, I'm not sure that that means we can know yet if this is unique to politicians. But again, what we do know is that power is corrupting, or it can be. And when you combine that with no transparency and little to no accountability, you really wind up quite easily in a situation where somebody can just abuse power. Add to that a staggering absence of women's voices in the halls of Congress, and it's not at least surprising to me as a woman and as somebody who's been engaged in public leadership in my own career that we might see this kind of phenomenon. You know, I think there are probably a lot of listeners out there who might think that this whole, hey, you want to change, elect women thing is a knee-jerk reaction. But in fact, where you've got more diversity of perspectives, you have more diversity of accountability. And that is going to have to happen here.
But in terms of people coming forward, sometimes after decades, to talk about what happened with a former partner. And let's face it, a lot of relationships, I don't even know what the statistic is, end in bitter acrimony, divorce, or nasty accusations, etc. I mean, I think as for as many relationships that are sustained over the decades, there are probably more relationships that break up. But I think that's a given. So is there any kind of legal mechanism here? You've got Schneiderman saying, in the privacy of intimate relationships, I've engaged in role-playing and other consensual sexual activity. I've not assaulted anyone. I've never engaged in non-consensual sex, which is a line I would not cross. Well, the testimony of the women in the New Yorker article contradicts that rather
adamantly, yes.
So, you know, on the one hand, there should be some privacy, I suppose. None of us would want our sexual lives exposed to the entire world. But on the other hand, there has to be some sort of, is there a possibility of the rules? I mean, we have the Fourth Amendment, you know, for protect against search and seizure. So we in our Constitution, we have a sense of privacy. But on the other hand, again, you get back to this roiling landscape between public behavior and expectations of public behavior and as opposed to private behavior.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that comes out for me in listening to your question is that we really do, for lack of a better word, have two court systems going on right now. We have the court of public opinion, and then in some cases we actually have the legal courts. And many of the accusations and consequences that it feels like we're seeing play out in the public sphere, right, whether you talk about Eric Schneiderman, or you talk about, you know, the accusations against Tom Brokaw 2 weeks ago. There's a court of public opinion that is moving quite rapidly, and where we have not fully established a set of norms and guidelines, you know, sort of our public opinion laws on this. And I think that's going through right now. Then you've got the question of, did someone break the law? And then there's the burden of evidence to prove it, so you've got to go to court, right? You've got to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that person broke the law and try them. There is a lot of gray area in between, but honestly, I think what we're trying to adjudicate publicly now is the rules of the court of public opinion first, especially for these public leaders, if that makes sense.
Well, it's very hard to see a kind of standard here, because you think about Charlie Rose. There was an awful lot of women that came forward accusing him over many, many years. And Matt Lau is even more. And it's pretty hard not to assume that the women are correct. Al Franken's a little bit dubious in the sense that the political operative working for Donald Trump, Roger Stone, was the first to say that we're going to come after, or I think he said something like, it's soon going to be Senator Franken's time in the barrel, as he had said earlier about Podesta's emails coming out before they were released by WikiLeaks from the Russian hacking. So, and then, of course, the very popular Prairie Home Companion personality, Garrison Keillor. There was only one woman that accused him, and that was somewhat ambiguous. So how do we write the rules here?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we're going to have to do is be able to have a thoughtful conversation about the continuum of offenses. And again, I am not an attorney. I'm not speaking of this from a legal standpoint, but a public discourse standpoint. Early on in the hashtag MeToo movement, there was very little patience for or oxygen for a conversation about the difference between, for example, behaving like a troglodyte and sexual assault. But as we move further into this movement and as we begin to have an opportunity to really begin to change norms and practices, workplace accountability, public understanding of what is acceptable, et cetera, we're going to have to be able to have a thoughtful and sophisticated conversation about this continuum, where we draw lines of accountability, how severe that accountability has to be, and how we adapt to our changing public and private understanding of acceptable behavior. That is just going to take time, and it's going to take people being adults about this conversation while at the same time being responsive to the pain of people whose victimhood has created real consequences in their own lives.
Well, just in closing, of course, people that are wringing their hands over the idea that Schneiderman's resignation means that there isn't a plan B in terms of the Trump inquiry if Mueller is fired by Trump. One of the people that's being suggested as a possible replacement is Preet Bharara, and you certainly couldn't get anybody better than that. So for those in our audience who are weeping over the fate of the Mueller investigation, I'd say you can save your tears for later. I thank you for joining us, Tatiana Deering. I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you for the invitation.
And again, I've been speaking with Tatiana Deering, who's a professor of social work and co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College, as well as the former head of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston. Her research focuses on social justice in public policy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the author of a brand new book out today, Trump Russia, A Definitive History. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Seth Hettner, who is an award-winning journalist who was a longtime investigative reporter for the Associated Press, where he covered numerous stories of political corruption and American war crimes. He is the author of the critically acclaimed book, Feasting on the Spoils, The Life and Times of Randy Duke Cunningham, History's Most Corrupt Congressman. And his latest book, just out today, is Trump Russia, A Definitive History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Seth Hettner.
Thanks for having me, Ian. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you. And the book, which Trump may not welcome, but is very, very necessary. We are all sort of in this netherland waiting for the special prosecutor to basically wrap up all of the stuff that's out there in the ether in terms of smoking guns. We're actually choking on smoking guns. But now you've gone back into Trump's history with the Russians, going back to 1984, and provided us with an awful lot of more and new information. So do you think this is all going to be a part of what's going to come out, even though under the special counsel statute that Mueller operates under, he's not actually required to provide the public with this report? It goes to the Attorney General, in this case, the Deputy Attorney General, and it may not even get to the Congress. So do you feel like we're in a holding pattern here?
Well, you know, what I think is happening is we're in the midst of a very thorough investigation. I think maybe a lot of people are anxious. They want this to... They want Mueller to weigh in, but you know, first of all, despite what Trump says, he's a Republican. He's a man who's committed to the justice system, to law and order, and he's doing what he's supposed to do, which is do a very thorough investigation. This is a really complex subject. There's a lot of moving parts, and you know, if you look at the history of special counsel investigations, they take years. Bill Clinton's during the Clinton years, we had one that I think went on for 6 years. So I don't think he's going to be done anytime soon, but I think what we are going to get from him is the truth. We're going to get a really thorough accounting of exactly what happened with Trump and Russia.
Well, but what you're revealing in the early part of the book is extraordinary, and there's so much information about these Russian and Ukrainian criminals that preceded the fall of the Soviet Union and had dealings with Trump. And, you know, the FBI must have an extraordinary file on this guy. Little wonder that Trump is attacking the FBI on a daily basis. I mean, to my mind, your book provides us with the evidence of why Trump is at war with the FBI.
Well, yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly right. Trump throws a lot of smoke. There's a lot of confusion. But when you look at his behavior, it's fairly consistent. And, the FBI, he's been on the FBI's radar screen for a long time. As you said, my book goes back to 1984. And that's when he first came across some Russian criminals, here in New York, where I'm at right now. And, it's only continued since then. He was chasing after Russian criminal money in his casinos in Atlantic City and his many building projects. And, what the FBI, he's been on the radar, as I said, has been on the radar for a while, and he knows that. And, the FBI, they are trained to look for, they deal with con men and criminals and grifters. And to them, Trump's behavior, it looks very familiar. And I think that's a lot of the tension that you see right now is, Trump doesn't like to be reminded of facts, and he attacks the messenger. And that's what he's done with Jim Comey. That's what he's done with the intelligence community. That's what he's done with the press. And I suspect that's what he'll do with my book. He does not like to deal with facts. So, yeah, I mean, when you look back at it, it's been a long, long series of relationships with the Russian mafia going back many, many years.
And it seems, though, that it's not just about money and money laundering, but there's also seems to be some kind of, I don't know whether Trump is a wannabe gangster, why he likes the company of gangsters, but he also, there's a sort of Slavophile thread here. If you think about Ivana Trump, yeah, with whom he had the children, Eric Don Jr. and Ivanka, they've spent their summers in Czechoslovakia during the Cold War, and Ivana speaks Russian, and she acted as Trump's interpreter on a trip to Moscow in 1987, where Trump was meeting with communist officials, high-ranking people. He claimed to have met with Gorbachev, which, of course, was one of his many lies. But I'm getting at the idea that, I mean, I'm told that that key meeting that took place in 2013 in the Rixroot Hotel in Moscow, when Trump wanted to meet with Putin, but as a kind of consolation prize, he had dinner at Nobu in Moscow with a bunch of oligarchs, and that that's where they kind of inculcated in him their kind of world vision, if you will. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is this is a long time in coming. How much is he sort of predisposed to that kind of culture and that idea of this kind of managed democracy that Putin and his criminal cronies have put together, where they've been able to control a country, control its people, and steal it blind?
Oh, that's a great question. So let me take that in pieces. So you mentioned that he's, you know, you see him as a wannabe gangster. You know, the way I would describe him is he's a mob-friendly businessman. So this started going back to Roy Cohen, his original attorney back in the 1970s, who helped him fight off a racial bias complaint filed by the Justice Department. And Cohen himself was a mob attorney, and he introduced Trump to this world, I think, in large part. You know, his clients ran a concrete company in New York, and that concrete wound up pouring the foundations and building the walls of Trump Tower. And when there was a strike called in New York in the summer of, I think, of 82, Trump's buildings were the only ones that were exempted. So I think he saw early on that there was a business advantage to being friendly with these people, that there was actually a competitive advantage that it gave him. And it did go from there. You know, you mentioned his 1987 trip to Moscow. That's a really interesting trip that doesn't get a lot of attention. But, you know, Trump, as we all know, is a very public millionaire, or as he calls himself, a billionaire. But he's at any rate, he's a wealthy man who makes no pretense of his wealth. And so when he went to the Russia in 1987, it was still the Soviet Union. And, you know, this is, of course, a country that abolished private wealth. So, you know, it's very curious that a public millionaire goes to Russia at their invitation. You know, at the time when, you know, Soviet television was depicting capitalists as literally as fat cats in top hats. And, you know, he comes back from that trip sort of predisposed to the Soviet line of thinking. You know, he takes out ads in a newspaper about 2 months after his return, taking up almost the Kremlin talking points on Japan. That Japan, you know, one of the Soviet Union's goals at the time was to drive a wedge between the U.S. and Japan. And that's a line that he took up upon his return, and he also immediately starts making noises about running for the presidency. So, you know, I think he's been predisposed to this line of thinking for a long time. I, you know, that's kind of what has been missing from the Trump-Russia story is a sense of history, that this isn't a news story. You know, you mentioned the 2013 trip to Moscow that he went for Miss Universe and met with Agalarov and had dinner in Nobu. And that was just a culmination of many, many years. I mean, you could almost say grooming of being cultivated and wined and dined in Moscow. And, you know, a man, as you know, as we've come to see with the Stormy Daniels story, Trump is an eminently blackmailable person. And someone who behaves like that in the Soviet Union, I'd be very surprised if they didn't have something on him that they could use for leverage.
And again, I'm speaking with Seth Hettner, who is an award-winning journalist who was a longtime investigative reporter for the Associated Press, where he covered numerous stories of political corruption and American war crimes. He's the author of the critically acclaimed book Feasting on the Spoils, The Life and Times of Randy Duke Cunningham, History's Most Corrupt Congressman. And his latest book, just out today, is Trump, Russia, A Definitive History. So that raises the question of how long he has been a Russian or Russian intelligence asset, going back to the KGB and now, of course, FSB and SVR. And, of course, all along there was the GRU, Russian military intelligence, and many of them have been kind of competitive. But, you know, the Russians have a term, polyesny durak, the useful idiot. How would you characterize the hold that they have over him? Is it just financial, about money laundering, or is it political, or is it about blackmail, or is he a polygyny Dulek, a useful idiot?
You know, I think the best case scenario is that he's a useful idiot. You know, it's quite frightening to contemplate the possibilities of a president being a foreign agent. But you know, it does seem that you know, just judging by his behavior, his strange admiration for Vladimir Putin, his desire to bring him to the White House against his own advisor's advice, his off-the-cuff remarks to the Soviet ambassador, and just so many strange occurrences I can't explain it. I don't know exactly whether it's financial. I don't know whether it's, you know, blackmail, or something else. But I would be very surprised if they didn't have something on him that is causing his such strange behavior towards Russia.
But could it be, going back to the kind of gangster world, and some of the stuff, by the way, that you've revealed is extraordinary, how many gangsters got into Trump Tower. Michael Cohen, of course, played a role in bringing them in, and they were buying up condos right and left, and then starting the sort of poker game that Trump came to. So he obviously likes hanging out with these people. One of the most bizarre stories is about these two mafiosi, Frankie the Bug and Big John, trying to do a hit against one of the mafia, as the Russians call it, mobbed up guys in Trump Tower. So it's an amazing story that you've done, Seth. It's really, I think, a public service. But let me just bring up the possibility of an analogy with Manafort. Manafort, as we know, was frantically trying to raise money and falsify documents, which is what the special prosecutors got on him. And now that judge sort of basically suggested that maybe they were going too far. But the long and the short it is that Manafort, I think he got about 30-something million from Deripaska, who's a very bad dude that the U.S. wouldn't let into the country for the longest time. I think he's on the record, he's killed about 42 people in the aluminum wars as he took over and became the aluminum magnate. He lends Manafort a bunch of money. Manafort squanders the money, steals a lot of it, and then Deripaska leans on him, and you don't want to owe money to these guys, I guarantee you. And then suddenly Manafort gets the job as Trump's campaign manager, and suddenly all is forgiven. And Deripaska is offered private briefings, and the Republican platform has changed to be more Russia-friendly. And then the minute that Manafort is booted out by Jared Kushner as the campaign manager, and they bring in Bannon and Kellyanne Conway, suddenly the heat is back on from Deripaska, and he sues Manafort for $20 million. And Manafort, I imagine that some of what the special prosecutor is dangling before Manafort to get him to flip or squeal is, do you want to go into a U.S. prison and be subject to a hit from a Russian gangster, or do you want to go into witness protection? So if that's what's happened to Manafort, could that also be happening to Trump? In other words, if they've got so much on him, and you know he never pays his bills, he stiffs everybody, could he have stiffed the Russians, and could they be threatening him?
I think, you know, as you said, Oleg Deripaska is not a person you want to be owing money to. He is a scary guy, and you know, there's an FBI agent who's quoted in my book that, you know, this is a FBI guy who chased spies and terrorists and all kinds of things, and he said one of the few people who ever scared him was Oleg Deripaska. That there's something about his eyes that just sends chills down your spine. But you know, I think the reason that Manafort is under so much pressure from Mueller, and you mentioned the judge kind of talking about the squeeze they're putting on him, you know, the reason is because Manafort was offering that back door to Russia. I think that's what Mueller is going after. That Manafort was, you know, sat down with he met with Trump, he offered him his services for no money, sat down with him at this private conversation that nobody overheard. And nobody knows what was said, but I think what Mueller is angling for was Manafort offering this backdoor to Putin through Deripaska, and that's one of many backdoors that were going on during this campaign. And, the Trump Tower meeting and between Don Jr. and Russian lawyers is another one. There were many others. But it's clear, it's clear that Russia was really trying to put its hooks deep into this campaign.
So in the case against Manafort, I believe the issue in terms of the law and what Mueller is working on, Trump keeps talking about collusion, which is not a legal term. But the real legal term is conspiracy against the United States. And that seems to say it all, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think everybody's gotten hung up on this word collusion. I think a simpler thing for people to understand is corruption. That if money is if you're promising things in exchange for money or services, that's what's going on. I think Trump was corrupted a long time ago by Russian money, that he came to depend on it when he was on his knees after bankruptcies in his casino. And he came to find that it was a ready source of money that was available for him when he needed it. But yes, I think the crime at a crime that could be possibly proven is if Trump had knowledge of the hacking as of the Democratic National Committee, as the Steele dossier and others have suggested, that's a conspiracy to commit a crime right there, and that could be prosecuted. So there's many different ways to go at it. You can go at it through money. You can go at it through the hacking. There's a lot of potential for possible crimes here.
And I mentioned earlier Frankie the Bug and Big John. The reason that the hit didn't happen was they were waiting to shoot this guy in the parking lot, underground parking of Trump Tower, and they dozed off, right?
Yeah, so that's a wonderful story. So let me just set that up for your listeners. So, what happened in the early 80s, Trump befriended these Russian criminals here in New York who bought a block of apartments for about $6 million. And Trump had convinced them it would be a good investment, and they went ahead and bought it. But they were running a lucrative gas tax scam in partnership with the Italian mafia, the Colombo family. And everybody got caught. The state noticed that they were missing millions of dollars in tax revenue, and they figured it out. So these Russians pleaded guilty to various crimes. And one of them, who pleaded guilty to a tax-related infraction, he was serving his home detention in Trump Tower. And while he was doing that, the FBI said, well, we're going to look at you for charges. So all of a sudden, he's facing a much more serious prison sentence, and he starts to cooperate with the FBI. And he meets with them many times. And the Colombo family, the mafia, hears about this. And, the penalty of you're a rat. The penalty of being a rat in the mafia world is death. So this character named Frankie the Bug, Ciortino, who was a capo in the Colombo family, was sent to kill him. And, one of the differences between the Russian mafia and the Italian mafia, the Russian mafia are often very well-educated. They have master's degrees. Italian mafia, basically a bunch of hoods. So they went out to kill him as he was one of these Russians as they were who was serving his home detention in Trump Tower, and this Russian was driving a Rolls Royce. So their plan was to set up and kill him as he walked to his Rolls Royce. So first day he strolls out and he leaves before the Russians even get there. So they come back another time and they try again. This time they get there early. But they get there so early that they fall asleep, and when they wake up, they realize that the Russian has taken the Rolls Royce and driven off again. So the third time, they figure it out, and they're going to wait for him, and they're going to take turns sleeping. And while Frankie the Bug is sleeping, he has an accomplice in the car who by the way became went into the witness protection program and told the FBI this, and that's how we know this, and that's how the story's in my book. But the other accomplice there was just sitting there bored waiting for someone to come out of Trump Tower, and he sees the blinking lights of a bagel store, and he's bored and he's hungry, and he starts thinking about a bagel and leaves the car and goes and gets a bagel, and when he comes back, the Rolls Royce is gone, and once again they've failed their assassination attempt.
That's one lucky potential hit. So just in closing, let me ask you about, we talked a lot about Ivana and the kids spending their summers in Czechoslovakia during the when it was a part of the Soviet bloc. The other thing that has come up, of course, is Michael Cohen. Your book, of course, has also revealed it before the New York Times did, about his how mobbed up he is, going back to his uncle Morty, who was the doctor for the Lucchese mob family. And again, his history is similar to what we've been talking about in terms of all these other mobsters. But it seems like Michael Cohen, through the marriage to the Ukrainian daughter of Afima Shusterman, Laura, has gotten into that world as well. They own these catering halls. Uncle Morty had a catering hall that the Italian mob used, and the father-in-law of Michael Cohen has a catering hall that the Ukrainian and Russian mobsters use. But also Manafort's married to a Ukrainian as well. So there does, in all of this, both in terms of Trump, Manafort, and Cohen, there are these sort of familial ties through marriage.
Yeah. I've gotten a lot of news out of this book. I think the biggest news so far has been the stuff about Michael Cohen. But the interesting story behind that is, you know, I didn't set out to report about Michael Cohen. I was investigating these Russian mafia figures we've been talking about, and was just calling former federal investigators. And it's one of these stories as a journalist where you kind of stumble into something, and people are just waiting for the phone to ring because they have a story to tell. And I hit upon one source, and before I could even start asking questions, source told me, you know, you might want to take a look at Michael Cohen because he's connected to this whole Russian mafia world too. And you've gone into some of those. You know, there was this catering hall in Brighton Beach that his uncle owned, and Michael Cohen actually had a share in that catering hall until Trump's election. He gave it up at Trump's election, which is an interesting connection. But that catering hall was the headquarters for the Russian mafia in New York. And Cohen married into a Ukrainian family. His father-in-law has a criminal conviction for a money laundering-related crime. And what my sources were telling me was that, you know, the way Michael Cohen got into Trump's world was through his father-in-law. That his father-in-law was a conduit of money into Trump's businesses, a sort of silent partner, and was helping funnel Russian money into Trump's businesses. And it was as a favor to the father-in-law that Trump took on Cohen. So, you know, the Russian mafia is a theme that runs through Trump's life, it runs through Cohen's, it runs through Manafort's. And, you know, we have a president who is, I don't know why people aren't screaming this from the rooftops, but we have a president who is a mob-friendly businessman who's chased after Russian criminal money for decades. And, you know, that's the story I think people need to know and to understand, and that's why I wrote the book.
And that is, in essence, Trump's business model. Russian laundering, Russian mob money. Well, Seth Etner, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Seth Etner, who's an award-winning journalist who was a longtime investigative reporter for the Associated Press, where he covered numerous stories of political corruption and American war crimes. He's the author of the critically acclaimed book Feasting on the Spoils, The Life and Times of Randy Duke Cunningham, History's Most Corrupt Congressman. And his latest book, just out today, is Trump Russia, A Definitive History. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.